And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Carrie M. from San Diego.
Wow. Hi, my name's Carrie. I'm an alcoholic. Where's Larry? Where'd he go? Larry, thank you for inviting me tonight. This is truly a gift and one of those things that I've been blessed with in Alcoholics Anonymous to get up and share my experience, strength, and hope with a bunch of people who have felt the way I feel, who have seen the things I've gone through, and who live today with me in my life the way it is. So thank you. My sponsor's here. My fiance's here. And there's a lot of people in this meeting that have been with me on this journey. So I'll go ahead and start. Thank you. I'll start in the beginning. I was born in Massachusetts in 1969, and I was the second child. My father was an alcoholic. He was in a bar on the night that I was born. Nobody had any idea where he was. I was born 10 days before Christmas, and my mom had to go and find him to bring him back to the bar and or bring him back to the hospital. And you know, I've heard that story my whole life about how this disease has, you know, just ransacked its way through my entire family. My father's in AA now. He has 25 years. I have a brother who is in AA. He's got 16 years. And I have a mother who should be here, but, you know, hopefully she'll find her journey. So, you know, my parents got divorced when I was 18 months old. I had a brother who was 2 years older than me. He's about 23 months older than me. And my grandparents moved to California. And my mom decided that she wanted to follow them. So she came out here to California. And I remember my first memory in life was standing in that parking lot and saying goodbye to my father. And not really knowing when I was going to see him again. And moving to California. And I moved here, and my mom moved into a little one-bedroom house, and she was a waitress, and my brother and I pretty much took care of ourselves. We did that for about 2 years, and she waited tables and drank, and my brother and I ran the streets and took care of ourselves as little 4- and 6-year-olds. And when I was 6 years old, my mom married a man who had 3 children, and he was the head electrician at San Diego Gas and Electric. And so my mom was you know, welfare mom, and we were her kids, and we moved to San Carlos, and we moved into a 5-bedroom house, and I now was the sister of 4 brothers. One of them had cerebral palsy, and there was 2 older than me and 2 younger than me, and this man became my stepfather, and he was the kind of person where the entire time he was my dad, I don't think this man ever told me he loved me. I don't think he ever hugged me. I don't think he ever acknowledged my existence unless we were in some fighting battle because I'd done something that he didn't approve of. At a very early age, my mom put these ideas in my head that the only thing that he was there for was to pay the bills. And so I learned at a very early age that men were good for paying bills. And that was it. And she told me that when I was 18 years old and my brother and I were both 18 that she was going to leave him. So what I also learned as a 6-year-old little girl was that I didn't have to respect this man. That not only was he going to be my stepfather, but I didn't have to respect him because we were leaving anyways. And so my whole young age, I just pretty much did whatever I want. My mom never put any limitations on me. She never gave me a curfew. She thought that everybody else had to be in at a certain time, so I would go home. She never told me no. I was given everything I possibly needed. She had a daycare center. We had a lot of money. And I was just handed life on a silver platter and had no accountability for anything I did in my life. And so those were the parenting skills that my parents had raising a young girl. And so those are a lot of the parenting skills that I took with me when I became a parent. Was thinking that it was okay to just let your kids do whatever they want and they needed to be your friend and that you couldn't tell them no. So what happened to me when I was 17 years old was I was driving down Lake Murray in Lake Arrowhead. I had taken my mom's car She told me it was okay. We didn't have insurance on the car because my stepdad wouldn't put insurance on the car for me to drive. And I took the car and I went to Sioux Plantation. I was working at the Sioux Plantation on Fletcher Parkway. And I was driving home and I went around the corner and I hit an 86-year-old woman and I killed her. And I was 17 years old. And not one person in my life ever said to me at that point, how did this affect you? How do you feel? Do you want to talk about this? Do you need counseling? All they said was, well, now we're really going to get divorced, and I have to put a second on the house, and this is going to cost us a lot of money. And it was just shoved under the rug. So pretty much my whole life, that's how everything was. Every time something happened or there was a feeling or a thought, nobody ever talked about it. And after working my program and after being a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, I really learned about those old ideas and where we get our thinking from after working the steps and after really taking a look at who I became and who I was and what I had as parents and how I dealt with my feelings and where these character defects came from and how come they're so glaring today and some that are worse than others and some that are better than others. And so after that, you know, it's funny because in 1988, everybody was graduating from high school. And after I hit that woman, I had a best friend for 25 years. And her and I started going down to Mexico into TJ right at 17 years old. And that's when my drinking started. I hit the lady, never acknowledged it, didn't know why I started drinking, had no idea. I do now. I know why I started drinking now, but I didn't then. And so my drinking took off, and I became a daily drinker at 17 years old. And excuse me, I remember in June of 1988 when everybody was graduating from high school. I turned 18 December 15th, halfway through my senior year, and I was 18, and I dropped out of school. And she was 3 months younger than me, and she called her mom, and her mom said, "Yeah, it was okay if you drop out of school too." So we had this great idea. You know, tons of great ideas. I always have had great ideas. So we had this great idea. We were going to go to Kearney, and we were going to get our GEDs, and the only thing we were going to do was go down to TJ. And so that's what we did. I mean, we thought we had a really good life. And so started going down to TJ every night, drinking, and everybody was graduating from high school, and I went home and told my mom that I was getting married. And I wasn't getting married because I was pregnant. I was getting married because I met a guy in Mexico, and he was in the Marines, and I wanted to get married. And my mom never looked at me and said, "You might be too young. Maybe this isn't a good idea." She didn't tell me any of that. She says, "Well, let's plan a wedding." And so that's what we did. We planned a wedding. And I look back at that now, and I remember the neighbors coming to the reception, and I remember these kids that I was graduating. She had invited them all. And I remember they were all at this reception, and I'm cutting the cake and so happy that I'm getting on with my life and marrying this Marine. And I look at 18-year-old girls now, and I think to myself, oh, my God, what was I doing? You know? And these mothers must have been looking at my mother thinking, what are you doing? Letting your daughter, who's everybody's graduating in 2 weeks, and she's getting married. And so that's what I did. I got married, and we moved up to Camp Pendleton, and 3 months later, I had a baby. And my daughter was born, and she was about 6 weeks old, and I went right back to drinking. And back to the bars, I had a fake ID, and I was a daily drinker again. And it didn't matter what I drank. I remember going into the bars and saying to myself that I'm not going to drink beer. I need to drink two shots real quick, and then I'll drink beers, and I'll be good. And once I drank that first shot, I could not stop. I love the effects produced by alcohol. Had no idea what this disease was. Nobody had ever explained it to me. Nobody in my life had ever one time said to me, until the day I got sober in 1996, do you think you might have a problem with alcohol? Nobody. And I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, is the very first person that said something. She might have a problem. I didn't know anything about this. I had no idea. This was a mystery to me, this program. So I continued to drink and had another baby. And in 1991, he was 16 months younger than my daughter. I was 21 at the time, on his 21st birthday. I went to a bar. I didn't drink, but I still had to go to a bar. I still had to be in that bar scene, you know, back with the Marine Corps and doing the whole Marine Corps wife thing, you know. They'd go to Okinawa, and I'd have a baby, and my kids would be left with babysitters, and I'd be off and running. And by the time I was 24 years old, I was a daily drinker, and I had three children. My son was born in 1994. I had three kids by the time I was 24 years old. And, you know, I know this is an AA meeting, but I have a little bit of my story that I'd like to talk about another issue. And I'll just say it was I used this to lose weight. In 1996, that good friend of mine came to me and she says, I'd like you to try this. You're going to lose a lot of weight after you have your son. And so I tried it. And the kind of alcoholic addict I am, I don't try anything. I have to do it. I have to say to myself, this isn't good enough for me. I don't want to pay this kind of money for this. So I'm going to go ahead and buy this, and I'm going to do this, and now I'm going to live off this, and I don't need to work anymore, and now my friends can do it for free, and we can all do it for free. And so, what happened to me was I started doing that, and within a year, I couldn't understand why none of those women had their kids. I didn't understand. How come these women don't have their kids? They would always say to me, you know, no, I don't have my kids. Where are your kids? Oh, they're with my mom. Or I had no idea. I had no idea what I was doing. I knew that I used. I knew that I used a lot. I knew that I spent a lot of money on it. And I know that in 1996, I dealt $7,000 worth of crystal meth to an undercover cop, and I was on my way to prison. And I had lost my children, and I was on a bike, and I had a backpack, and I was homeless in El Cajon. And I didn't think I had a problem. I had no idea that I had a problem with drinking, with drugs, with anything. I thought everybody was doing this, and I thought it was very normal. And what happened to me was I was in Santee cruising around with somebody one day in a truck, and I know today that it was God, and I was getting on the 67 freeway, and something said in my heart, you need to go see your kids, because I didn't miss my kids, because they were in my way. And when my mom took my kids, I was happy, because now I was like those other women, because my kids were now being taken care of by my mom, and I could run the streets and do whatever I wanted. And I said I wanted to go see my kids, and he drove me out to my mom's house, and I never told my mom that I was an addict. I never told my mom that I was doing drugs the way I was. And what happened to me was a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous called my mom on the phone. I'd been there for 4 days, and I'd been sleeping. And she was yelling at me, telling me I had to get up and take care of my kids, and I couldn't. I couldn't. I hadn't slept in 2 years. I was exhausted. I weighed about 86 pounds. I was exhausted, and I was hungry, and all I did was eat cereal, pee, and sleep, and that's all I did. And I mean, literally, for 7 days. And when that woman called, she told my mom, your daughter's an addict. And my mom's like, no, she's tired. You know, she's just tired. And, you know, my mom told me a story a couple of days before she came to take my kids. She came into my house in El Cajon, and I sat her down, and I told her, I drew a pyramid for her, and I said that if you just give me $800, and I drew this whole pyramid out for her to show her that if she just gave me $800, I could turn this money into this, and I could turn this money into this, and then if you come by tomorrow at noon, I'll give you back your money, and then I'll give you interest. And I'll never forget this day. My mom looked right at me, and she says, I think I'm going to take the kids. And I'm like, okay, you know, you're going to take the kids. And here I'm like selling my mom Amway because I want her to help me, you know, buy drugs. And she didn't, thank God, because I don't know where my kids would be today, and I don't know where I'd be. So this lady told me that I needed to go into a treatment center, which my mom had no idea what it was. And this woman did. This woman knew about this program, thank God. And she knew about this program because there was people before her that did the same deal, just like we're all sitting here tonight. And that woman came and picked me up, and she drove me out to McAllister Detox. And I was there for about 45 minutes. And another woman that my brother knew in AA, because I didn't know my brother was sober. I didn't know he'd been in the program. My mom had called my brother, and my brother brought this woman out to detox and pick me up, and I had a black trash bag with my stuff in it, and this woman wrote a check for $47, and she dropped me off on the curb down at Volunteers of America, and I was 10 day at the time. And you know, I remember going into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was about this many people in there. It was an alumni meeting, and it was on the weekend, and there was a lot of people in that room, and everybody was going up to speak, and I was in awe. I was in awe because I could not believe that these people were talking about the things that they were talking about that I had just recently stopped doing in front of all these people. There was no way, like you hear at the podium all the time, there was no way that these people were clean and sober. There was none, and I didn't believe it either. And I remember sitting there on that wall, and it's funny because this man sitting in front of me was at the Salvation Army at the time in 1996, and I met him in detox. I was that boy meets girl on AA campus, everything you're not supposed to do. Well, it wasn't a success story 15 years ago, but it's a success story today. So it's kind of funny because you know, you're going to meet people in these rooms. You're going to meet sponsors. You're going to meet women. You're going to meet men in these rooms that you're going to take advice from, and you're going to take guidance from. And you know, when I first came into the program, I was 26 years old, and I was very influential. And there was a woman in the program, and she told me that I needed to stay at her house with her and not go into a recovery home. I needed to sleep in her room with her and not go in a recovery home. I needed to go to old meetings only with her, not have anything to do with my family. And I had no idea about anything about this program. And so I just did what she said. And I went to meetings, and I did about 12 days after I left detox with this woman. And a healthy woman in AA approached me and took me under her wing and walked me through the steps of filling out my application and getting into Crossroads Woman's Recovery Home. And she walked me through not going to prison. And she was there when I went to jail, and she told me what to do. And she was there when I called her from Las Colinas. And she was there to pick me up. And, you know, and I got a letter of recommendation from a probation officer who I still have contact with today. And this probation officer told the judge that I was salvageable, that I got mixed up with the wrong people, that I did it to start losing weight, that I was probably not an addict, that I deserved a second chance, and that I didn't need to go to prison for 7 years, that prison was probably not the answer for me. And I wasn't even sentenced to a recovery home. I was just told I was put on probation for 7 years, and I was a registered drug offender, and I couldn't drink, and I couldn't use drugs. And I swore to God that day that I stood in front of that judge, and he told me, Judge McGrath, he said, this is the first time in 25 years, he said, I haven't sent somebody to prison for what you've done. And I knew there was a God, because I was not going to prison. And I did go back to that recovery home, and recovery home for about 6 months. And so here's when it gets good. So you know when you hear in the program that get a sponsor, work your steps, go to meetings, do as suggested. I did that recovery home, and I was ready to go. And I thought that I had this program licked, and I thought I knew all the answers. I'd done 1, 2, and 3 in the recovery home, and I had a sponsor, and I was going to meetings while I was in the program. And when you're leaving a treatment center, you always say to yourself, and I've worked in treatment centers, so I know, you always say, I'm going to go to meetings every day. I'm going to call my sponsor. I'm going to work my steps, and you have all these great ideas. And me, I'm the kind of alcoholic addict who has great ideas. So I had these great ideas that I was going to get out of Crossroads, and I was going to go home, get my kids. Now, remember, I have 3 of them, and they're all under the age of 4. I'm going to get these kids back. I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to get on with my life. So what I did with that mother of mine, who will give me anything I want and doesn't know how to parent, has no boundaries and thinks that all my ideas are great ideas,
I called her and asked her to come and pick me up, and I said, can you help me get an apartment? She said, sure. Turn on my electricity and my cable, and within 4 days, my mom had taken this addict, alcoholic, out of Crossroads and handed me my three children and put me in an apartment, and I was on my way. And I managed to go to meetings, and I didn't work my steps, and I still had a sponsor for a while, and I took a one-year cake in AA, and I never read the book, and I think I might have worked one, maybe not, one, two, and three, still in the recovery home, tried to deal with those kids, got married in AA, thought my life was perfect, had another baby, so now I'm up to four kids. He has a child, so now I have five, with 7 months of sobriety. I'm pregnant. He's got 4 months, and we're ready to start our life together. Really good idea, right? So here we go. My alcoholic husband and I are going to raise five kids. We're going to try and do it. We're going to try to go to meetings. He doesn't have a sponsor, neither of us work in the steps. So we managed to do that for about 3.5 years, almost 4 years. And without a program, and without him having a program, I do what I do best. And I remember going into my last AA meeting, and I remember sharing about complacency. And I remember saying at group level, I'm very complacent. I can tell you guys, I had no idea what complacency is. Today I know what complacency is, but then I didn't. And I remember sharing about being complacent, getting up from that meeting at Rennett Park and leaving. Nobody stopped me. Nobody said anything. But I'd made up my mind that I wasn't going to do AA anymore. I thought that I got the husband. I had the cars. I had the job. I was a general manager for IHOP restaurants. I had the baby in sobriety. I had a house. I mean, I didn't need this anymore. I was fixed. And I went out one night on a date, which I shouldn't have been on. Because remember, I'm married and have all these kids. So I decided to go on a date because that's me and my great ideas, right? And the person I was out on a date with asked me if I wanted a shot of tequila, and I said no at first. And we got all the way through dinner, and because I'm the alcoholic that I am, I had my first shot of tequila with my dessert. I had cheesecake and tequila. And I was off and running. And, you know, the thing about my relapse was I couldn't go back to that man that I lived with and lay next to him and look at him and say, I'm an alcoholic and I relapsed and I need to go back into treatment, because I didn't have any tools. I had no idea. I did not have the strength to say anything and ask to go back into treatment. And I really didn't. I look back now and I didn't want to be in this relationship, taking care of these five kids, working as a general manager at IHOP at, you know, 28 years old, and I'd rather be drinking, doing what I wanted to do. So we ended up getting divorced, and needless to say, we ended up getting divorced, and I didn't tell anybody in my family that I'd relapsed. And so I became a different kind of alcoholic for the next 6 years. The kind of alcoholic I became was, everybody in my life thinks that Carrie's sober. Everyone in my life thinks that I'm perfect and I'm dying inside. Dying inside. I'm raising these kids because now I have the four of them. And I'm now the room mom in kindergarten. I'm now the PTA president. I'm now the softball mom. And Monday, I'm hungover. Tuesday, I'm hungover. Wednesday, I think about drinking. Thursday, I drink. Friday night, I drink. Saturday night, I drink. Sunday, I feel like crap. And nobody knows that I've drank. And I did that for 6 years. And what a miserable, miserable, miserable place to live. Because when you don't have anybody to really share your alcoholism with you, it's very lonely and it's very sad. And you die more and more and more and more inside. And, you know, over those 6 years, I was working at Sharp Memorial as a clinical lead, and a patient fell on me in 2004 and broke my neck. And I had a neck surgery, and I was recovering from a neck surgery and completely out there and didn't want to get out of bed, didn't want to take care of my kids anymore. Had this five-bedroom house, all these cars, these kids, this life, and that friend who had been my friend since seventh grade, the one that, you know, came into this program with me, came by and stopped by my house, and she asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous again. And I remember saying to her at the time, well, the last time I drank was Friday night, and she took me to a meeting, and I remember sitting in that meeting, and they read more about alcoholism, and it was the first time I'd ever heard that in my life. It was the first time that I ever heard that the last 6 years I had tried to drink like normal people. I had tried to convince myself that I was a full-blown drug addict and that I was not an alcoholic. And if I just stayed away from crystal meth, I would be okay. Because what I was waiting for was I was waiting for that bottom. I was waiting for that homelessness, that backpack, that you take my kids, that going to prison feeling. I was waiting for all that. And I never paid attention to what was going on in here. I never paid attention to me. You know, what was going on with me and how I was feeling and what had happened with those feelings my whole life all the way up until I was this age and all those things that I'd stuffed and all those things that I never shared about. And what happened to me when I first came back into AA was I had just had neck surgery, and I also had a back injury at the time, and there was a woman in the program, and she told me I could not take any mind-altering substances if I wanted to come back to AA. And so I quit my medication cold turkey, and I was about 48 hours into it, and I was sitting at an AA meeting, and I had my feet up on the chair, and I was in so much pain, I couldn't breathe. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, if this is what AA is all about, then I can't do this because my health is more important right now and I need to take care of myself. And this woman spoke at this meeting, and this woman had had four back surgeries in AA. And this woman was sitting there going through exactly what I'm going through, and I asked her to sponsor me. And that woman took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. She taught me how to check my motives, how to take my medication, how to write down what I was taking, how to take a look at what I was feeling. And those were things that I had no idea how to do. And this woman in AA taught me how to do that. And, you know, I took the 12 steps in my first year, and I took my 12th step at a woman's retreat up in Julian underneath this cross. And it was probably one of the most spiritual things I've done in AA. And, you know, I remember when I first came into the program and everybody was reading, you know, more about alcoholism and all these things in the big book that for the first time in my life, I surrendered. And I didn't know what that meant because I didn't even know how to take no for an answer. And I said, I'm willing to do whatever I have to do to stay sober. And in the book it says, how can somebody possibly like me take these steps? Because on the outside, my life did not look unmanageable at all. It was picture perfect. If you looked at me, you would think that there's no way this woman has a drinking problem at all. And how could I possibly take these steps? My life was not unmanageable. How was I going to do this? Well, it tells me how to do it right here in this book. And it tells me how to do it with somebody else in the program. And what I had to really do was take a look at how powerless I was over alcohol. You know, it says in the book that that's the one step that you have to do perfect. I was just reading that yesterday. Eric and I were just reading that. That that's the one step, being powerless over alcohol. So what I did was I surrendered to the fact that I was an alcoholic, and I started to educate myself on this disease. And, you know, I asked a lot of questions. And when I completed my 12 steps, I had been going to a woman's meeting because my first 9 months of sobriety, I only went to women's meetings. I stuck very close to the women's meetings. And then about 9 months of sobriety, I was going to meetings a lot, 3 to 4 a week, and then I started going to a structured step study. And in that structured step study, the men that go to that meeting are some of the men that started this meeting. I was one of the first people that came into this meeting the very first night it started. And that meeting had so much sobriety, from newcomers to 45 years of sobriety. And it was a structured step study. And what we did was we read the book. We read the steps page by page. We read the traditions. And as I grew up in sobriety, I learned how to start dealing with some of those feelings and realizing where those old ideas had come from and where I learned how to be the person that I'd become, and knew that the first thing that I had to do was concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic and that I did not want to drink, because not only did I not want to die, but I wanted to feel what a little bit of what I'd felt in those first couple of months of sobriety. I mean, I had that little light, that little bit of light, because I was around people like you. I mean, I went to coffee. I went to dinner. I worked my steps. I was around women. I was around men. I was asking questions. I was in this book. And I was like on fire for AA. I mean, I was on fire for AA. And, you know, so what I did after my first year is I got my first sponsee, and I got a sponsee right out of that woman's recovery home, and I started taking that woman through the steps. And I always had said to myself that I thought it was important for me to go to a woman's meeting, a structured step study, and then go to a newcomer meeting, because I think it's important, as you're getting your time together, that if nobody goes to the newcomer meetings and nobody goes to those recovery homes, you know, what's the experience, strength, and hope? It's going to be amongst themselves. And then they're going to have really no foundation or no tools, and they're going to go out and do what I did. And so my sponsor and everybody who was in my support group, my grand sponsor and everybody else, every Thursday night we went out to that recovery home, and we all worked with that circle of women, and we did things together. We did step studies at my sponsor's house, and we did coffee, and we started not only living our own lives and living our own dreams, but we got to see the joy in life to these women that had been me 15 years ago. And, you know, that, when I started sponsoring in my first year, I can probably say that sponsoring other women in Alcoholics Anonymous over the years has probably been truly my biggest gift. And watching those women, get those CPS cases closed and graduate from those programs and see them get that first car and see them get their kids back and watch them go to their meetings and see that light bulb turn on in somebody else's eyes is what I know today is my primary purpose in life. And, you know, I know at any time that if there's something going on with me, I just have to go work with another alcoholic. That's all I have to do. I just have to pick up the phone and say to somebody, how are you today? And not say, hey, do you want to hear all I'm doing today? Just have to ask you, how are you doing today? And, you know, over the years, that's one of the things that's worked for me. I learned in AA, I took the 12 steps right out of the big book, just the way it's written in the big book. And then about at my three-year point, I started working in a residential treatment center because I thought that that's what I wanted to do. And I remember hearing in the program that a lot of drug and alcohol counselors stop going to meetings and they make their patients their meetings. And when I first started working at that treatment center, I was going to meetings every day, and I swore to God, another one of my good ideas, that would not be me. I would not do what everybody else does because I always think I'm different. And I can do this different than everybody else did. And I started working at that treatment center, and my hours turned into, you know, 8-hour days, 10-hour days, 12-hour days, working on my days off. Now I'm salary. Now I barely even have time to go home and feed my dog, and let alone go to a meeting. And, you know, experience strength and hope. Nobody's even around me to experience strength and hope me. And all I'm doing is I'm at work, and I'm sharing my experience, strength, and hope, which I think at work, but I'm not sponsoring, and I'm doing exactly what everybody told me that I was going to do. And so after taking a look at that, I realized that I'd rather be a sponsor. than work in a treatment center because I lost myself. And, you know, working at that treatment center and going through that whole period of my life in AA, stopped going to meetings. I didn't stop completely. I just wasn't doing 3 and 4 a week. I was still maybe doing one or going to meetings with my patients or going to meetings with my clients and making sure I go to one just so that I could share or something. But it was probably about 6 months that it took me about 6 months to lose that whole, like, that spiritual place that I felt. And I knew that if I continued to do that, I was going to end up getting drunk. Because it didn't matter how many addicts and alcoholics I was working at work. I wasn't working on myself, and I wasn't doing my primary purpose. And so I stopped working there. And, you know, so right now I work in this restaurant. And I work in this restaurant Lakeside. And I went from my job as the aftercare coordinator of this treatment center to working in this restaurant where there's truckers and Harley drivers. And it was a very humbling experience for me because I remember sitting there when I first started working there and I pushed the coffee grinder thing and I'm grinding coffee into these filters. And I swore to God I would never do this again. I was on my journey. I was off, going. I was going to be somebody. I was going to work at, who knows, Betty Ford. I was going to be Betty Ford. I was going to go somewhere, right? So I'm standing there and I'm working at this restaurant and I'm grinding coffee. And I'm like, oh my God, how did I get here? Oh my God, what are they thinking? How can she talk to me like this? Who does she think she is? And I'm full on rolling the eyes and, you know, doing the whole thing, threw all my program right down the drain, you know. And here we went again. It took people in this program to tell me, you know, Carrie, wow, you're so lucky that you today work 3 days a week, that you're financially able to support your family, that you have a wonderful man in this program who's sober, who works. Every single thing you've ever written in all your inventories is right here in front of you. A man that's sober, a man that's not cheating on me, a man who loves my kids, a job I only have to go to work at a couple of times, as many meetings a week as I can go to, a sponsor, my steps, sponsees, step studies, anything I want. And I'm sitting there worried because I'm grinding coffee. So, I really had to get busy because, you know, in this program, I've learned that as soon as I start to feel uncomfortable inside or I start to feel like there's something wrong with you or you're not doing what I want you to do or you're not saying what I want you to do, it's probably time for me to write an inventory. And I write a lot of inventory. And I'm meeting with my sponsor tomorrow to go over some inventory. Because I'll talk to her sometimes and she'll be like, is that on your inventory? And I'm like, oh yeah, it's right here. It's all in here. And she's like, okay, well, let's share about it. Let's talk about it. And, you know, putting it down on paper and writing about it is one thing, but getting it out and working on that 6 and 7. Because a lot of us think that we're going to do 1, 2, and 3. We have a great God in our life. Our lives are good. They're going along. They're chugging along. Everything's going great. We've got the job, the car, the kids, the life, the woman, the man, the whatever we have going on. And then we're going to write it all down on paper, and then we're going to share it with somebody, and then we're going to stop. And 6 and 7 are so important, and because those are who make me, me. Those character defects and those shortcomings are, that's who I am. I can write all day long. I can write about what you did and what resentment I have and everything that you did. But when I really look at those columns and I really take a look at those inventories and really take a look at me and work 6 and 7, I can really get on with doing what I need to do. And that's work with another alcoholic. And that's pray and meditate and work with another alcoholic. You know, and if you're sitting in here and you haven't worked the steps and you've heard that this is a cult or you see somebody and their life's not going so good, because in the beginning it doesn't really go good. You know, when we first get sober, it doesn't really go good. I mean, I don't know about you, but everybody knows I'm an alcoholic now. And we can't trust her to be around our kids. And we can't trust her to drive our cars. And now everybody knows that I'm an alcoholic. And so, and my life wasn't so good in the beginning, really. And you know, it takes a while. It really does. It takes a while to start getting yourself back on track and doing your life. I'd like to talk about an experience that I just got to have. So growing up, I had a father who lived in Massachusetts, and I saw him every 2 years. And he got me every 2 years. I moved out here when I was 4, and he got me at 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16. And then again, after I was married at 18, I went back there at 19 when he got married again. And so he saw me every 2 years, and he always took my older brother with us. And so my brother was always like his golden child, and I was just that child that I hear a lot in the program that I felt different. I hear that a lot. I felt different. I felt out of place. I felt like I didn't belong. I never remember feeling that until I looked back when I was in AA and I said, wow, that was me. I never like sat there when I was 12 and said, wow, I feel different. I feel different. I think I need a drink. I feel different. I was just going. I just was going and never stopping and drinking and partying and, you know, hanging out with everybody and had no curfew and did whatever I want. And it wasn't until I got sober that I could look back and realize how much I wanted to be different and how much I felt unloved by the men in my life. And after I did those inventories and I started digging down really deep to find out who I was, I never felt different. I just did my life and had nobody guiding me except for me and my best friend. And so my dad took us out there every 2 years, and he got sober when I was really young. I was probably about 8 years old. I remember my grandmother beating him with a shoe and telling him, your kids are out here from California, and you need to take them out and do something with them. And he took us to Martha's Vineyard, and he was always hungover, and I didn't really like him. I didn't like him because I didn't know him. And I didn't like him because my mom didn't like him. And so if you're a parent and you don't like your ex-wife, just let me tell you. I didn't like him because he didn't pay child support. I didn't care if he paid child support. I had everything I needed, but my mom didn't like him because he didn't pay child support. So he was a loser, and he didn't love me, as far as I could see as a child, because that's the only thing I heard. Remember, I kept hearing, don't respect your stepdad because all he's good for is nothing because I'm leaving him. Don't respect your real dad because all he's good for nothing is because he doesn't pay child support. And so that's all I kept hearing. I never heard any of the good stuff. So my dad brought me out there every 2 years, and after looking at this recently, I realized that it didn't affect my mother that he didn't pay child support. I don't know how it affected her, actually. I know that I had everything I needed as a child, right? And so I know that I did not learn to love that guy. I did not learn to love that man. And recently, Eric is also from Massachusetts, and his mother just died in March, and so we were able to both go back to Massachusetts, and I was able to go back to Massachusetts and really for the first time without my brother, because my brother's gone on every single visit with me to Massachusetts since I was little, everyone. And the very first day I got there, I was sitting at a picnic table with my dad. And my dad has no idea what kind of program I've worked all these years, and he has no idea what I've done, and he has no idea what I've accomplished. And the reason why he has no idea is because I haven't called him. Because I haven't shown him, because I haven't been around him. And so what I've been doing is I've been doing AA. I've been doing AA, and I did not do it with my family. I did it with my kids, but I didn't do it with my dad, and I didn't do it with my brother, and I didn't do it with my sister-in-law. And so none of them knew me. And so when I'm sitting there talking to him, he says to me that, well, maybe you should call your brother because he doesn't really believe that you're sober. He thinks that you're lying, and none of us really believe that you're sober. And so my pride and my ego just like, oh, what do you mean am I sober? And I want to start rattling off everything. What are you talking about? And then I realize that the only thing that I can do right now is just enjoy the next 10 days with this man and show him what kind of woman I've become and be there and be present and talk to him and show him what I've done to raise his grandkids and show him what I've accomplished by just being there, by doing nothing, by just being there and sitting with him and talking to him. And so the day before we left, he walked up to me and he put his arm around me, and he says, wow, you've really turned into an amazing woman. He says, and I really love you. And I was like, wow. And so I changed my name when I was 6 because my mom told me that she wanted me to have the same name as her, as that stepdad that raised me, but my brother didn't. He kept my real dad's name. So I came back to California, and I put my real dad's name back on my Facebook. It was just one little step, and I got some mail for my real dad today, and I have my real name on it, my name that I was born with. And, you know, I know that that the things that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is I have 4 children, and my children, thank God, I've been in AA while I've been raising them through their teen years. My son is an alcoholic addict, and he graduated from drug court at 18 years old. And so I did drug court with him. And while I was doing drug court with him, I was doing teen court with my daughter because she was running away, smoking pot, and out of control. And when she was 17 years old, I was going to take my first year cake. And my daughter told me that she was pregnant with my granddaughter. And I'm truly blessed today because I was able to go and meet with that sponsor at that meeting on Sunday morning that's on Porter Hall and tell my sponsor that my 17-year-old daughter was pregnant. And she said, it's going to be okay. And I knew that. I didn't at the time, but I knew that everything had gone okay and that God had provided no matter what. And that my daughter was 17, and she was going to have a baby, and there was nothing that I could do about it except for be her mother and love her and become a grandmother at 36. It's what I was doing. It's what God gave me, you know, and it's what I did. And as my daughter's pregnant, my son's going through drug court, and he's running wild, and he's on house arrest, and he's, you know, doing all this stuff, and I could not have gone through any of this, without my God standing right next to me, because it's just me and him, and members of this program. Because every time I had something going on with one of my kids, I could pick up the phone and call anybody in these rooms. And there was always somebody there that had either been through what I'd been through or knew somebody that had been through what I'd been through. And so, you know, here I got this drunk kid in my living room who's beating up his friend on my 40th birthday. And what do I get the next day? I get 4 male members of Alcoholics Anonymous who come over to my house and sit me down and say, we're here. That he needed it. So my daughter, again, after I have my granddaughter, who I absolutely love, her name is Serenity. She was born in my first year of sobriety. Her name is Serenity Michelle. My daughter told me again she was pregnant, and I was a little disappointed because I know the statistic of teen pregnancy. So my daughter's going to have another baby, and she's married. Her husband's in the Navy, and she's married, and so had to realize through AA that, you know what, I'm not supporting them. I'm not paying their bills. You know, they're paying their own bills. He's in the military, and this is what they're doing, and they're on their journey. And what I can do now is be a sober mom and a sober grandma. So my daughter had my second grandson, and his name's Drayden. And about a year ago, my daughter had another baby. So I got to be a grandma again. So today, what I have is I have a 22-year-old daughter who just bought her first home in Winchester. And she's got 3 of my grandchildren, and she has a son that belongs to her husband who she's had since he was 6 years old. And I get to go up and paint my granddaughter's bedroom with Hannah Montana paint and wallpaper. And I get to participate and be, you're just my favorite grandma. I'm just their favorite grandma. And I get to be a part of that. And I get to be a part of my mother's life. And you know, something I realized in these rooms is it would never benefit my mother for me to go back and tell her what she did, how much she affected me, or whatever. I just know that right now, I just tell her, you just did the best you could do with what you had to work with, and I know that I utilize these rooms and these steps and the people in them to continue to work my life and my program. You know, if you don't know anybody, and I've been there. I've sat in a meeting and not known anybody. I felt alone. I felt alone in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this is simple, but it's as complicated as you decide to make it. Find somebody to read the first 164 pages out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Find something that you can relate to. Stop looking at the differences. Look at the similarities. Find somebody that will just be willing to just do this deal. And I promise you, there's so many people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that would just be thrilled, because when they say, "You have no idea how much you're doing for me," they're not kidding. My life is truly amazing today. I know I'm not even halfway through. I know I'm not even a quarter way through. But today I just know that, you know, sharing my life with my children, with Eric, having a sponsor, reading this book, writing those inventories, and working with other alcoholics is going to keep me alive today, because I do not want to die. So thank you for letting me share.